Hey Blenders, on this week's episode, we're going to talk about Wonder Woman 1984 going to streaming. We get deeper into the Mank conversation, and Sean Astin joins us to discuss the Lord of the Rings trilogy on 4K.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hello, Blenders, and welcome to episode number 145 of Real Blend, a podcast that is co-hosted by two Lord of the Rings fans. My name is Sean O'Connell, the managing editor here at Cinema Blend, and on this week's show, Wonder Woman is going streaming, but also to theaters, and that's pretty exciting. We're going to go deeper into Mank, David Fincher's film, on this week's episode. We've talked about it before, but we're going to go into some really interesting aspects about maybe rewatchability and the fact that it's going to be available to you guys on Netflix starting this week. And then the Lord of the Rings joke is because the great Sean Astin is joining our show. And this, the special part about this is that he's joining us to specifically talk about Lord of the Rings. And we kind of make a joke with him. I'm not sure if it makes it into the interview, where has, like, if we got Sean Astin for other projects, we would have to, at the end of that conversation, try to sneak in a Lord of the Rings question. But here we get to just gush about all things totally geeky Lord of the Rings. And I think fans of the franchise are going to find it to be really, really exciting. Almost as exciting as the fact that Jake Hamilton from Fox 32 in Chicago is here with us. Hi, Jake.
Well, even if you're not a Lord of the Rings fan, I think you would enjoy the... And I don't know, Sean, did you enjoy the interview?
I did enjoy the interview, yes, and I came up with, I thought, some decent questions for Sean, and Sean was very nice to Sean, and it went well. It went very well. And Kevin McCarthy is enjoying some time off, getting a little bit of rest, and so we are introducing Gabe Kovac. Hi, Gabe. How are you doing?
Introducing?
Not bad.
Well, for this week's episode.
Yeah, for the episode.
For this week's episode.
I'm here. I'm always here, but now I'm really here.
Yes, producer Gabe is diving in. It's going well. This is weird. We're talking about the fact that we're rusty because we took a week off.
Yeah,
and we're trying to figure our way through all this again. But bear with us. We'll get there. Starting with housekeeping. If you're watching us on YouTube, hello, thank you very much. Head down to the subscribe button. Hit it. Hit like as well, too. Turn on your notifications. Do all the things you're supposed to do on YouTube and can help us continue to grow that channel. If you are listening to us in all the places where you get your normal podcast feeds, be sure to check out the video form because we do some really cool things, especially because more of these interviews that we're pulling off, Sean Astin being one of them, we get to video. And so you guys get to see the reactions of our conversations and how things sort of go that way. And sometimes with Michael Cicchino, he pulls props out, which is always sort of fun, too. Gabe, I'm supposed to throw something to you?
Oh,
I'm sorry. No, what? Tell them about what?
We need to, there's a, one of the benefits of the video format, specifically with this Sean Astin interview, is the three of us were, or all of us, were having a conversation about I guess the definition of what it means for a film to be independent. Yeah. And Kevin kept referring to the Lord of the Rings as independent films, to which it bugged me to no end. Like really bothered me that he referred to the Lord of the Rings trilogy as independent films. And I was like, dude, like, they're $1 billion films, man. They're not, they're New Line, they're Warner Brothers, they're $1 billion films. They're not independent films. And there's a moment where Sean Astin casually refers to the Lord of the Rings films as independent films. And if you have the video, if you're watching us on YouTube, look at all of our faces. Because we all just go like, bitch. And Kevin's face just has this, like, knowing, I told you, like yeah. So much is translated. And Sean's still talking, you know, he's still answering the question. But there is a communication between all of us in that moment where when Sean refers to the films as independent, where I just thought, son of a bitch.
And I'll since I'm filling his role completely, I'll fill in for Kevin, and because he and I was more on his side, and I understood what he was saying by independent, because it's more of the way that it's made is an independent spirit versus it the nature of it's the spreadsheet that put it together. You know what I mean? Like,
oh, that's the idea. I am a what does it like? What is the definition? Like, what?
Yeah,
what,
yeah.
What is
no,
it,
no,
you know?
No. You're right. You're right.
And even the way that Sean describes it, which we'll get to in a second, it's like he said they basically just landed in New Zealand and like rolled up to bed and breakfasts and figured they would camp out for a while and make these movies. You have to remember back then,
I
like
feel
nobody
like
really
that's
knew what these were.
Oversimplification. I feel like I have a feeling just... Warner Brothers didn't drop $300 million and they just rolled into New Zealand and started filming.
No, it was just Peter Jackson and a camera and a couple actors, and they just worked it out.
And just a little bit of makeup, just like a little bit of powder.
Worked it out. Yeah.
All right, so...
The update I was supposed to give, yes.
Oh,
YouTube
yeah.
update.
Please.
For listeners, for people who like to watch the YouTube channel, it probably will not affect you that much. I know because I watch the numbers. We are no longer doing the Clips channel.
Oh, yeah.
We are kind of shifting resources away from that. The regular YouTube channel, the main channel, is going to remain the same. We will still upload there. That's where you're going to sub. The clips that are on the Clips channel, we're not going to shut that down. They'll be there, but there'll be no new uploads. Anytime we have spoilers or something like that that we clip out, we'll just go ahead and put it on the main channel. So you only have to subscribe to one.
R.I.P. R.I.P. Clip Show. Or Clips Channel. Yeah. The weekly poll for this week, we talked about December releases. And I'm excited for this reason. We're starting to get into some titles that feel like they have some weight to them. With all due respect to the films that have been screening this year prior to it. But like some films that are flirting with theatrical release, including Wonder Woman 1984. Some films that I think have some Oscar potential, if and when the Oscar ceremony finally does get here, in Soul and Mank. And so, Gabe, because you're in the chair, and whenever you're here... Oh, shoot, but you did the poll.
Do you think I outsourced my job?
It's so fun to include you.
Yeah.
I forget that you've added the poll to the thing. Yeah, I know.
I can answer, though. I look really smart.
No, I don't want you to answer. No. Jake. Your yep. choices for which December release are you most excited for? We gave you Soul, Wonder Woman 1984, and Mank, and we also gave Other. So of those, which do you think prevailed with the blenders?
I'm going to say 1984, Wonder Woman, just because I feel like the poll came out not too long after it was announced that Wonder Woman was going to HBO Max.
Right. Yeah,
I felt like people were super jacked about that.
Yeah, 53%. And honestly, of those titles, I mean, that one just... We've been deprived of blockbuster entertainment for so long. And even the films that have tried to somewhat replicate the experience for their audiences at home, it feels like Wonder Woman 1984 finally is the film. And in a way, I really am glad that Warner Brothers is striking ahead and letting this movie come out and it seems working in a lot of different ways to compromise with Patty, to give her an opportunity for it to be in theaters in places where it's safe for people to go to theaters and potentially experience it. It's weird because I looked recently here locally because I hadn't been paying attention to whether theaters were even open in Charlotte or not. And it turns out that the AMC theater chain is open here, but the Regal is not. And I wonder what's driven the decision that one of the chains would decide to close because it's not mandated by our state. Everybody with the poll picked Wonder Woman 1984. But with Soul, it's our job to sort of start beating the drum for this movie. I guess I kind of understand that people know it's Pixar and they'll get as excited as they would for a normal Pixar film. Your varying levels of excitement, but Soul is phenomenal, and I want more people to get really excited for it. It's coming to Disney Plus on Christmas Day. It's directed by Pete Docter. He's made a number of fantastic Pixar films. Jake finally got a chance to catch up with it as well, too. I think if more people knew how good Soul was, it might have competed a little bit harder in this poll. I know we can't review it per se, but what can you give me a reaction to your thoughts on it?
Ugly cry, man. Ugly, ugly, ugly cry. But it's so interesting. You talk about... I guess just reaction not being that high, I feel like it's you know, maybe for, you know, an older guy, like, I know Pixar movies are going to be good. Mm. It is short of the Cars movies, short of like Cars 2. I know they're going to be good, but I still feel like there's a reset every time. You know, it's like, despite the fact that they have a pretty incredible, you know, like, record, I still don't find myself getting excited. Like, I know it's going to be amazing. I know it has a legitimate chance at being on my top 10 list every time one comes out. But I still, like, whenever I know there's a new one next year, I'm like, oh, cool. Like, I'm excited to see it. Cool. Mm-hmm. And then I see it. I'm like, oh, well, like, why don't I get more excited about these movies beforehand? You know, I think it takes seeing it just to be reminded of how... That being said, how do I phrase this? Who is the audience for Soul?
Yeah, no, that's a tremendous question. Because it's not kids.
Yeah,
in the least
it's not kids at all. Because it asks some very big existential questions. And I think the emotional beats are only going to hit you if you have a little bit of life in you. If you've lived a couple of years.
But there's still... I haven't seen Soul, full disclosure. But it still has... I guess for a really young audience, from what I can tell from the marketing, it still has like super cute characters and Pixar kind of swagger to it.
There's enough there to keep kids engaged 100%. I mean, it's still Pixar. They still know how to entertain.
This will be, from what I'm gathering, it'll be one of those movies where people who are like 9, 10, 11 right now and love the movie for whatever they get from it at 9, 10, 11 are going to watch it at like 25, 30 and go, oh my God.
I didn't realize get what it was about.
I didn't realize how much this crushes.
I'll kind of say this. The way that Inside Out sort of looked at the emotional components of, at least Inside Out was looking at the emotional components of a kid, right? So it played with like, this is how a kid would react to certain things. These are how the kids of the emotions would be personified. And I think kids, at least on that level, could react to, oh, sure, of course, I understand what this girl's going through. She's sad or she's lonely or she's angry or something. This is the emotional reactions of a full-grown adult who's at a very specific crossroads. And when you see it play out, you're like, you rethink your life. You rethink your life.
Yeah.
And that's not for kids. And so, but I'll be really fascinated to see how it ends up playing Christmas morning.
Yeah, ask an 8-year-old. So, like, what dreams have crushed you in your life? Like, what did you hope to do that you weren't able to pull off because you're dead?
So we'll move on because I know we're going to end up doing a full review thing, but I'm curious, did you guys have any expectation that you were going to like it nearly this much, that it was going to hit you this well, or had you kind of written it off in a way?
No, the first thing that got me excited for it was the reaction out of BAFTA where the it had its premiere and the reviews were off the charts. And then I was like, oh, okay, it's going to be really interesting. And I'll even add this, Jake, and I don't know how you feel about it. The first time through, I thought it was fantastic. But I even still, there were a lot of things that I had to sort of process about it. Mm-hmm. And I immediately went back and rewatched it again like two nights later. And I thought it was that much better the second time. I've seen it a third time already.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, because it was in our screening log for Disney Plus for a couple of days. And I love it. I love it that much. And so, no, I didn't expect it. I didn't expect to react to it that way.
The trailer for me, I thought was really creative. Just how so often how Pixar visually represents something. The second act, not to give too much away, I thought I didn't like the second act until it progressed further. And then I was like, I don't think I like this as much. And then by the end of the second act, I was like, oh, nope, I'm back. I'm sold. Like, all right. Cause you reset me and I'm back into it. I don't know. It's a hard movie to want. Even
we'll
if once we're
to
allowed
it,
to talk about it, it's going to be difficult to do it without ruining it for people.
See, this is what I meant about exciting movies coming that have a lot more weight to them. Things that we can discuss. Sure. But let's instead, hop in the Wayback Machine and discuss a film, that is celebrating some type of re-release. It's not for an anniversary. It's just the 4K release of the Lord of the Rings films and the fact that Sean Astin was able to join the show. And again, we're so thrilled that it was specifically because he was promoting the Lord of the Rings trilogy. And so here is, without further ado, the Real Blend Conversation with Sean Astin on behalf of the Lord of the Rings 4K release.
Well, thank you so much for doing this. We're joined on Real Blend by Sean Astin. This is an honor talking about the Lord of the Rings 4K Blu-ray release, which we're all so excited for. Sean, I don't know if this is a question that you might take a second to think about, because I'm just interested to know. Do you remember the first scene that you shot in Lord of the Rings and the last scene you shot? It doesn't have to be linear from a storytelling standpoint. I'm just wondering the first day you had on set as Samwise and remember the last day.
Vividly. The first scene was on the wooded road, which means a lot to the production like design folks, and because it was the first time we were all together and the ring wraith was there. But Frodo says, get off the road. And we all jump over the tree and we're hiding together under the tree, the four hobbits, and the ring wraith lands above us with his hand, and like that it animates all the spiders and creepy crawlies on us. So that was the first one where we're all robed over our thing because it was in public. It was basically like going into Central Park and shooting a scene like on the rocks in Central Park, because in Wellington, New Zealand, where we filmed, it was basically Mount Victoria. It's just a, you know, you joggers would go by. It's pretty great. So, and then the last shot it's a scene that always makes me cry in the movie when Aragorn turns and looks at us and says, "Oh, my friends, you bow to no one."
Yeah. That was the last scene.
That was the
shot?
Last shot. It was just a shot of the four hobbits. My last shot. The movie had more to do, but
yeah, sure.
The four hobbits were basically just stood against a green screen or blue screen or whatever, and we just hit it, and the camera just kind of did a little push in, and we all gave this sheepish like, oh, I guess they're all bowing for us, or oh, a little humble about all that. So that was it. That was the alpha and the omega, as it were.
That's amazing.
Do you remember the two word good cut? Ones. Do you remember the word cut being said and what you were feeling?
Yeah, it was a very. You know, it was, we were on prison time. Everybody was counting down for the last 3 months, you know, and I think they must've chosen that for that, or at least saved it until that moment, or it was a controlled thing. It was inside of the warehouse at Stone Street. And it was, which was the studio down there. It's an abandoned paint factory. It's an old paint factory with like, every time the wind blows, the windows rattle and stuff like that. But, and you know, there was champagne. There was, I don't know if that was, I don't think that was the end of principal photography, but it was definitely a wrap on the hobbits. And we went around as a crew, the hobbits. It was like, oh, the hobbits are on set. Are the hobbits traveling to set? You know, where are the hobbits? Are the hobbits eating again? You know, where are the hobbits? So that, but that was, and then they did a little ceremony where they presented, gifts, you know, like they gave me my backpack, the Sam's backpack and Sam's sword, not Sting, but Sam's, you know, working class sword, if you will. And you know, Galadriel, the light of Elendil, and a little salt box and all this kind of stuff. And they gave us, Allie, my oldest daughter was, I guess she was 4 or 5 at the time, 3 when we went down there. She played Eleanor at the end of the third shoot, like in the last shot of the last scene of the last film, the little girl comes running down the pathway to Sam and he's like, well, I'm back. Mm-hmm. That was my played by my daughter. She was my daughter. And by the time we finished, the beautifully exquisite hobbit flowery dress that they did was way too small for her. She was twice as big. Like the amount of time that it took to film, the child outgrew, you know, doubled in size and outgrew the dress, and they gave us a dress. So that was crying. It's always crying. If it's Lord of the Rings, crying's in
Well, keeping with the theme of first, I had the great pleasure of interviewing the great Ian McKellen for the first Hobbit film. And at one point in the interview, he kind of like broke into Gandalf and kind of did the character for a hot second. And I will always remember like the physical effect that had on me. Like I got chills and almost kind of got choked up for a second because it's such a part of my life, such an iconic part of pop culture. But I was curious about—
Imagine going to a gay bar with a guy.
Oh, no, Campbell, tell me those stories.
Tell us that story, please.
Well, he, you know, he's very, very proud, out knight, if you will, benighted, you know, knight of the realm of the United Kingdom there. He took us all around. He took us to in Wellington and wherever I didn't know there were gay bars in Wellington. I thought it was more conservative, but no, man, it's a vibrant scene. And if he breaks into Gandalf in that setting,
wait, did he do that? Would he break into Gandalf in gay bars?
No, no. Uh-huh. Well, he can't. Gandalf is him. He is Gandalf. No, the funny thing about him is he's so cool. He's just so cool. He's the kind of guy, you know, when he walks in a party, he's just in the corner, you know, and the energy kind of swirls towards him, but he doesn't, you know, this is a guy who does Shakespeare, who stands, you know, Hamlet or whatever, King Lear, and he stands in the middle of the stage and just commands centuries of, you know, dramatic audiences. But he walks into a party and he's just like I don't know if you ever saw him do SNL, but he's just like smoking cool dude. So anyhow, you know, we all had that feeling, you know, when he came out. I remember when they settled on his nose. They settled on what the nose was going to look like for him, and watching a true master at work, you know, it's like from the outside, it might've just looked like a guy going like this in the mirror. So what I was basically saying is, like, you know, when you have, I think of like Peter O'Toole, right? Think of those big 70mm sweeping epics, or like Gone with the Wind, or any of those movies that just existed on a massive canvas. You know, you got to think that those stars had, you know, at the point of where the technology was when they're making Lawrence of Arabia is what I was trying to spit out there, but their iconography. You know, what did Lawrence look like with that turban on? Like, that's what was happening with Ian McKellen looking at his wizard nose and his wizard beard. You know what I mean? He understood, or he was designing for himself. I think the character, this, you know, storied character in literature and this children's character, I guess, on some level, but there's like, how are you going to thread the needle with making it just, playful, whimsical enough that it honors the whimsy and everything, but also substantial enough. And I just remember him looking at his nose and making a decision that, like, yes, this was, you know, not too big and not too small, not too round and not too pointy. You know what I mean? It was like, it was a privilege to watch that moment. And so we all get that feeling from him when he says anything. I mean, he probably gave me the best parenting advice I ever got from anybody. We were at shooting the Hobbiton stuff in, I think it's called Mata Mata.
That's where I went for my honeymoon. I went to the Hobbiton in Mata Mata. I went to that exact place.
And I wasn't there to buy you an ale and congratulations.
Sean, I texted you, man. You just didn't show up.
It's upsetting. Well, there better be some sort of an anniversary where we can coalesce down there. But we were there. We were staying in these. You know, it was a low budget indie. It was like a student film, the way we made it. You know, there was a lot of people and a lot of stuff, but the whole vibe about making the movie, we all jumped in our cars and we drove up there, and most of the actors found bed and breakfast that we wanted to stay at. And, you know, and we happened to, Ian and I happened to, and my wife and daughter were there. And she was mesmerized by a sprinkler. She was only three at the time. She was mesmerized by a little the sprinkler going back. And I remember going over, my whole way with her was to explain everything and to use big language. And like, I really wanted her to, you know, just inhabit all of this world that she could, even as because kids have so much capacity, so much more capacity than they're usually credited with. And so I'm describing to her how the water works and the spigot works and all this stuff. And he was sitting, you know, I think we were having tea or it was cold out, you know, and there's like a little, you know, patio or something. And he goes, wow. He goes, if you explain everything to her, she won't be discovering it on her own or something like that. Right. And I was like, oh my God. Like, there's something to letting children discover things in their own way, in their own time. I'm like, that's it. He said one little thing and it changed my entire life, you know?
Yeah, wow.
A man who's lived a lifetime. Sean, this is the new copy, obviously, which everybody can get their hands on. And I will turn around and put it on a shelf next to four other copies of Lord of the Rings. There are certain movies that just whenever a new one comes out, I have Jaws. Kevin has about seven Terminator 2s. I'm really curious, what is your movie that whenever a version of it comes out, you just get it because you have to own it? That's your movie.
I mean, I think the corollary for me is what movies I must watch. Gladiator, L.A. Confidential,
nice.
Shawshank Redemption, mm-hmm. Patton, Lawrence of Arabia. I mean, I remember the only thing that I think is fits for me in terms of like purchase, because who buys anything anymore? What is that wall of items behind you? I
don't know. Yeah, relics. A bunch of relics.
Dude, my wife and I have a 1600 Blockbuster Blu-ray collection. We come down here and rent movies, man. We do it every weekend.
I had Laserdiscs. When Laserdiscs were a big deal, I turned 18 when Laserdiscs were at their zenith, and I bought Alien and you know, just anything. Was The Fugitive available? I feel like I got The Fugitive. Oh. You know, my personal taste though is, I feel like I'm different people. You know, depending on who we're talking about. You know, I'm Back to the Future and Fletch. Yeah. That's one Sean. Yeah. You know, the other Sean's version I was just describing to you there. I have many, you know, we love television stuff now. We're like, I just watched 3 seasons of Turn. Have you guys seen Turn?
No, but I've heard it's amazing.
It's really, really good. The great thing about Lord of the Rings for me when we made it and why I loved Alan Lee's illustrations, you know, he's one of the two prime illustrators. And really, and Alan Lee and John Howe is a brilliant, incredible artist, painter, illustrator, and when I say illustrator, I mean like museum quality artwork. You know, you can go to the Louvre and see these guys' things. But Alan Lee, he was really, and Peter credited him with being the sort of visual soul of the movie. That his interpretation of the books in his lifetime of work treating Tolkien. It's really you can take those. We would literally hold up his drawings as we were acting out a scene. Like there was a scene where Frodo and Sam and Gollum are at the Black Gates, and we're looking over this rock at the Black Gates that are opening up, and the orcs are marching out or whatever they are, Uruk-hai or whatever. And it's the cover illustration of the bound 3-book volume. And we literally had the book, and we were positioning ourselves in the camera to mimic the drawing that he had done.
It's like your basic storyboards, basically, essentially.
Basic storyboards, wow. Yes. And on and the coolest thing about them was, for me, they seemed like history. Mm. You know, there's a scene in Rivendell when Boromir arrives and Sean Bean arrives, and he's looking at the murals, the painted murals on the elven walls that depict the history of man, and the Narsil, the shards of Narsil, and all that kind of stuff. Anyhow, there's something, the level, the attention to detail, and the reverence for what's being depicted are so honest that it's, you know, because there can be a kind of comic book thing. Like John Howe, he depicts, there's one thing where Sam has the light of Elendil, the Galadi light, we call it, and the sword, and he's diving in the drawing at Shelob. Like he's running and he dives. It's an action shot. And it's like, it's a comic book. It's real. It's kinetic. It's colorful. But there's something like artistic and historic, and there's kind of, I don't even know what the word is to describe it, but I love those movies. I love histories and biographies. Mm-hmm. And what I loved about Lord of the Rings was that it was real. It was as real as even these, you know, fantastic little hobbits and the orcs and the elves and the dwarves and the, didn't matter. The more real they were, the most painful thing Peter Jackson ever said to me, you know, he's a man of few words. And he, you know, he's very, very stoic guy. I mean, he can be performative when he wants to or needs to. I mean, he can act things out, and he's very eloquent and so forth. But you know, on a day-to-day basis, Peter Jackson is basically like a quiet guy.
Yeah.
And you know, he sort of lets the work do the talking. And his direction was always very, you know, minimal. You know, but mostly his direction will be, let's do it again. You know, we do like 1,000 takes, you know, another take, let's do another take. And you're like, it's dark. Everybody's gone home. We're going to do another take. Okay. but he came up to me at one point and he looked at me and he said, I just didn't believe that. Mm. Oh my God. He might as well have, it was like a Mortal Kombat death blow. It was like, he ripped my head off of my body and my skeleton, my spine came with it.
And you've never heard that before? Is that the first time you've heard that from a director?
it was true.
Yeah, okay, gotcha. Mm. Gotcha.
It was true that I was not invested, that I was out of it. Mm. I was out of the character. I was out of the mood. I just wasn't there. And you know, you listen, when you're making movies, you know, you pull up. I'm very aware of like the mechanics of things. Like all that's going to be remembered is, you know, a shot that's like this or a stunt that gets done or a whatever it is at that day. But I'm aware of like driving to the set and where you park and where the crew is eating and what kind of dressing room there is and how the AD is feeling that day. And like, I'm very aware of the actual mechanics of the making of the show. And I think I was just kind of like distracted and thinking about and just not in it. And there could be a lot of reasons for it, but he said that and it was like, oh, it was brutal. He didn't mean it to be brutal. He meant it to land. He didn't mean for it to be brutal, but it was a perfect piece of direction, and he was absolutely right. And it made me better. It made me focus harder. The only time I felt like that after that was a year later when we came back to do pickups for the Two Towers. And there's a scene where with Shelob, you know, I spent a week with one of the directors, Jeff Murphy, one of the second unit directors, filming the Shelob fight sequence. And it was really exhausting. You got this big backpack on, you're flopping yourself on the ground and scrambling around. And like, you know, you'd think to look at it like, oh, you're a kid, just play. But I don't know. I was like, I was tired. It hurt, you know? We kept doing it. And then like we go back and he wanted to get the hero shot where like Sam steps in to a hero moment and the camera, the dolly comes in and it gets real close and he goes, get away from him, you filth, or something like that. You know, like some great Harrison Ford line of hero line of dialogue. And the reverse of which, by the way, is Peter Jackson's arm. He really wanted to play Sam's arm. So when you see the scene, Shelob is there and Sam steps into frame with one of those kind of hero, you know, help has arrived moments. And it's Peter Jackson's hand on the sword. And then it cuts around to my face and I literally, they did the dolly shot and the way we filmed it was they did a little piece of rock behind us, not even a green screen, which in a weird way has its own, you know when you're on a green screen that you have to give it, you have to bring it, you know, you have to be there. You have to perform. You can't just exist in the space because it's green screen. So in a weird way, it's almost a dramatic prompt when you're on a green screen. Now we just had a piece of rock behind me and we were on the, again, at Stone Street Studios and on the cement floor basically, which, you know, usually when you step into the set, the floor is dirt or the floor is whatever the set is. And you wouldn't think of it, but that, it affects you. It affects where you're standing, what you're wearing, what you can see. Everything affects what you're doing. And so we, you know, it was kind of artificial. It was an artificial moment and he did it. And I said the hero line and I just, my heart wasn't in it. We did it again. And I was just like, shit, like, I didn't know what was going wrong. And I prided myself. You know, when we first started filming, the film culture approach to creatures in green screen was Jurassic Park. It was Sam Neill with the pole with the tennis ball on the end of it. I was like, okay, the T-Rex is the tennis ball, you know. But ultimately at a certain point, if you really focus on the X, the tape X or the tennis ball or whatever the point, the fixed point they want you to look at, it actually, to my eye, it looks like you're looking behind the animated character once the animated character's on screen. So to me, what I prided myself on at the beginning was being able to see Gollum or see the spider or see the cave troll. Like I could see it, my imagination, like I just believed it and I could play a scene with an actual cave troll right there in my mind. And I knew, I think I was complimented a couple times, but like, it works for the effect, for the special effects when they start putting the digital character on top of it. So when we were doing this pickup, I couldn't see the spider. I was like, the camera would come in and I'd go, get away from him, you filth, or whatever. And I'm like, I can't see the spider. I can see Cannes Film Festival. I can see the Oscars. I can see, you know, all of the, Vanity Fair covers that we did. You know, the movie had become this big cultural phenomenon. All the talk shows, all the like everything that went along with Lord of the Rings becoming a part of the culture for a minute there, and like I couldn't. It really, it took, I was so disappointed in myself at not being able to see the spider at that moment. But I did reacquire Shelob, and hopefully it shows on the screen.
Sean, I wish we had more time with you, man.
Yeah, we had so many questions for you, but I think our time is up.
Yeah, but we really appreciate your time so much. Anytime you can come back and talk about these films or your entire career, we would love to have you back.
Well, I appreciate that you're promoting it. The funny thing about the cinephile marketplace is people are always clamoring for more of what they love. They want the remastered, they want the new version, they want the additional, you know, scenes, the added scenes, they want bonus material, whatever. But then when someone like, you know, like Warner Brothers, like New Line, they're like, okay, you know, here's this, here's another one, here's another one. You take it. So I personally have not yet seen the 4K. But I'll be watching it with the rest of the audience. So
we were laughing about this opportunity though, that normally these are the questions we would have to squeeze in at the end of another interview with you. So it's great to just be able to openly gush about this.
We were going to get like super geeky. I wanted to get into like the force perspective and all that kind of stuff, but we'll have to do that another time with you. I love the way it was shot. So.
Well, it's funny cause we said a few things, like I hadn't talked about some of this stuff in the 8 trillion times I've talked about it. It was a little bit different. It was a little unique. We're going to have to put out a 4K version of this interview.
Hey, that's a compliment. that's the ultimate. Anytime someone says that I've never talked about that before after talking about things for years at this point, that's the best compliment in the world.
Yeah. Well, it's you guys. You guys are legit.
Thank you, Sean.
I'm only going to ask you this really quickly because I know you have to go. Is it true that they dug holes that the actors would stand in to look shorter than the other actors to make the hobbits look shorter?
Every possible permutation of manipulating height and size. So holes, you know, apple boxes to stand on, getting on your knees. I'm sure Peter had already thought of it, but when we were doing the rehearsals before we started filming, and I was like, well, what if we do it like this? What if, when he had a little camera out or he had his viewfinder out or something like that? It's funny because it's 20 years ago and it's really hard to remember a time when there wasn't, you know, it was Napster. Do you know what I mean? It was there was no, there was, you know, email was a thing, but there was barely any tech, you know, that you, to sort of, you know, to speak of. And it evolved, like as we were filming, things got more and more advanced. Like, you know, just the idea of this kind of phone call was not possible then.
This kind of video thing, and you sort of forget, but
I remember being like, well, if I get down on my knees and you put the viewfinder right behind me and I'm looking up, isn't that like just as good as forced perspective? Isn't that just as good as it's in fact way better than forced perspective, because forced perspective gives you context, but in terms of being emotionally like connected to what you're talking, like in the drama of it, it's literally you can't get close, because the closer you get, the more you reveal that the perspective is being forced. So what you really want is that perspective, and then you want a close-up on Ian McKellen's face or close-up on Elijah Wood's face, and that's where it lives. So
well, Sean, thank you for ending on that. I appreciate that. That was the one thing I really wanted to ask you, so thank you for that. I appreciate that.
Cool. You guys are awesome.
All right, we'll let you go.
Thanks, stay healthy, safe, and strong.
We have to thank Warner Brothers Home Entertainment for giving us time with Sean Astin. That was honestly, and again, full disclosure, you guys know, I've said it on the show before, I'm not a huge fan of the Lord of the Rings series, but to be able to sit down with him and discuss the impact of that trilogy, the prevalence that it has in our culture, of course I'm fascinated by all of the behind-the-scenes stuff of how this came together, and to hear him talk so lovingly about his experience was really fantastic.
Did you ever do any of the junkets or the Hobbit junkets?
No, I didn't do any.
You never did. You didn't do any of them.
No, because by then I had no interest. I was off that bandwagon, and Eric Eisenberg, who writes for Cinema Blend, is a huge fan of that world, and so any opportunity that we got to sit down with that cast, it was his right at the bat. So that's always one of the fun things at Cinema Blend with the staff, is being able to send someone who is a full-blown fanatic to go and cover something. And it's hard with like Marvel or Star Wars or something. Like, everyone's a fan, right?
Sure.
But when you have a niche project that somebody is super geeked out about, and then you'd be able to send them to to go cover that. Is that's
like I hear you small... guys were
it's like an independent film, like The Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, an independent film.
Yeah,
I hear you guys have a Tom Hanks interview coming up.
We do have a Tom. Well, I mean, listen, if it happens, you know, these things.
Yeah.
Who's assigned to that one?
These things come and go. Right now it's me. right now it's going to be me.
I hope you have a wonderful time.
And you know what's strange? This will be the second time that I will have interviewed Tom this year. You know, since I also got him for that submarine movie.
You know what my greatest hope is? Is that out of pure muscle memory, because I assume you're going to be doing this interview from this very desk that you're sitting at
yes.
now. Out of pure muscle memory, you're wrapping up the interview with Tom Hanks and you just yell Larry Crown and he's just a deer in headlights.
Gabe, I'll make you a promise. If I get him, I will end the interview with Larry Crown.
Oh yeah. God. Yeah. All right, you heard it here first.
We have to cut that clip and put it on. I know even we don't know how to cut our junket stuff and put it
on. I mean,
on the
even
show.
If I just find a clever way to just be like, hey man, I was a big fan of Larry Crown.
Don't you fucking lie. No, right, you don't deserve to trade barbs over Larry Crown.
It wasn't good.
How dare you, sir.
Right, stay tuned.
A movie cannot star Cedric the Entertainer unless it's entertaining.
That's a good point. Yes, that's very true.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Talking points. So we mentioned the fact that you guys being excited for Wonder Woman, and the huge news that broke since the last time that we recorded is that Wonder Woman 1984 is coming to HBO Max on December 25th. I'm sorry, Christmas Day. It's going to be available in 4K and HD resolution and all the bells and whistles. It is going to be available.
HD resolution, sorry.
What's that?
HDR is what you were looking
HDR?
For. HDR? 4K HD resolution. Yeah,
you got it. Sorry. Sounds good. It's going to look great.
You tripped me up.
It's going to look fantastic. And it's going to be available in some cinemas where it is allowed, where it's going to be safe to be able to go back to theaters, where audiences will feel safe going back to theaters. This is kind of interesting, though. As Gabe puts in the notes, it's going to be in cinemas in the UK starting on December 16th. As a spoiler culture, like, aren't we concerned about important stuff getting out, and how angry our U.S. audience is going to be if stuff starts to hit the internet because of the fact that it's playing someplace else?
The only thing I could think is that happens all the time.
Yeah.
So
with big Marvel movies.
Yeah.
Not
it's
that,
a bummer because
Wonder Woman's DC, but like,
yeah,
but the first time
big
superhero movies. Yeah.
Yeah. The only thing that's different, I guess, is there's so much buildup for this because, as you were saying earlier, it's, you know, it's kind of the first major release we're getting that we're really getting, because Tenet was only in so many theaters and had so much interest. So I think there's just more weighing on it for people because they finally get something. But, you know, it's always happened that way. So.
And the gist being that they have gotten their protocols in better place in the UK. Is that why they're able to go a little bit earlier than we are, or... was that the rationale given behind it?
What I was reading was, I didn't see much about that, but they had, basically, it seems like they're doing a much better job of, from what I gather, of communicating with studios and kind of putting forth a plan for like a temporary solution because we're in the middle of an emergency, as opposed to here where it's, we've had this wishy-washy sense of what's going to happen, what's not going to happen. Depending on the director, are they going to get, you know, a theatrical release or whatever? It looks like they've shortened this. They've created a shortened window the way that we've started to do across the board and committed to, like, we're just trying to make this work for as many people in the industry as possible for right now. But in no way is this the future of what we want to do. So
I find that interesting that they're taking that stance, because it feels like that's the stance that Tenet probably should have pushed forward at the time of... hey, we understand everything's sort of out of proportion, right? And let's compromise and do a theatrical option for people who can and a VOD option for people who don't feel safe going that route. And if Tenet had sort of been the groundbreaking film to be the first one to do that, I wonder if more studios might have followed their lead through the rest of September, October, November, and Black Widow would have had a very limited theatrical run and been on Disney Plus by this point. It feels like Wonder Woman now is saying we're going to be the trailblazer that implements this dual outlet model, and we'll see how it works.
And I think it's hard to say that this decision isn't at least informed by Tenet's
100%.
I don't know. I don't want to use the word failure, but like it didn't do what anyone expected or what it seemed they were expecting to do. So this is at least informed by that in some way.
Now, Jake, I know Kevin and I, because we have the press days coming up, we have the option to see it in a theater. You do not in Chicago, correct?
I'm going to be seeing it. We're all doing the junket coming up. I am going to be watching it at home, unfortunately.
Are you?
But like a lot of people are.
Theaters are you bummed?
I'm bummed because other people get to see it in a theater.
Oh, really? Interesting. Okay.
You know, like you and Kevin have that option. And Warner Brothers was very kind and asked if I wanted to see it in a theater. And I was like, unfortunately, I can't. Like, theaters are not open in Chicago. But, you know, I also got to see Tenet in a theater. And a lot of people did not. I know a lot of people in L.A. who are waiting to see Tenet for the first time when it comes out on Blu-ray. I mean, could you imagine if, you know, if we hadn't seen a Nolan movie that had been out for 6 months by now?
I forget about that sometimes.
Yeah.
I'm like walking around. I'm like, oh wait, these people haven't seen Tenet.
A huge chunk of people have not seen Tenet. Yeah. I'd be lying if I said I weren't bummed, but it's also the world we live in. And the fact that, the fact that we even get to see it, I think it's, it's a big, I don't want to say sacrifice on Warner Brothers' part that they're putting it out, but the fact that they're making it, I will say that of all of the big movies that have started to be made available on video on demand and streaming services, this is the one that I've gotten the most family members, like friends, reaching out. Hey, like when is Wonder Woman come? Like oh, it's HBO Max. Oh, cool. I need to sign up for. Like there seems to be a massive. You know, we've talked about whether or not Tenet was the right one to kind of be the one through the door. You know, Tenet was always a hard sell.
Yeah, but it also was the wrong time. I think
I agree with you 100%. I agree. Yeah. You know. I think people came at that movie with knives out no matter what happened. But I think...
That was a couple years ago.
No, that was 1 year ago, believe it or not.
1 year ago.
Isn't that crazy? Yeah. But no, I think Wonder Woman's going to be a massive success. But to answer your question, long story short, I am bummed that I'm not seeing it in theaters.
Yeah, and again, you say like it's a sacrifice for Warner Brothers, but in a way it's not, because what they'll get is HBO Max subscribers.
Sure.
I wonder how many people sign up for these things, watch what they want to watch, and then cancel them.
Doing is they're getting the conversation going about other things. Like, yeah, you'll sign up for Wonder Woman, but oh, my neighbor's been talking about The Undoing for a month now. So like, well, I gotta watch The Undoing. And like, oh, like I heard someone talk about Flight Attendant, and Flight Attendant's on here. So you really start building up those secondary titles. You know, the limited series and stuff like that. You bring people in with the Snyder cuts and the Wonder Woman's, and then you keep them around because they need to finally binge that series that their neighbor's been talking about.
That'll be really interesting to see, because I'm assuming, you know, their team is smart enough to know that like when Wonder Woman launches, they need to be really particular about what they put around it. You know, like when log into the UI, you're like, okay, what are we going to show these people to hopefully do exactly that? So that'll be really interesting to see. Like, I wonder how much Snyder Cut stuff is going to happen around Wonder Woman, just because all the people that are in flux, Snyder Cut's maybe a little bit more niche than Wonder Woman. So it'll be interesting to see the marketing.
That's
around that.
So interesting. The same way that when you go see a big summer blockbuster, the trailers before it are usually other big summer blockbusters.
And the date that I'm hearing more often than not for Snyder Cut, though it's never been confirmed, is March. So
isn't there a book coming out in February that would
funny
really prepare
you
people
should
for that?
Mention that. Yes, funny you should mention that. That the Snyder Cut released the Snyder Cut available on Amazon and all
Gabe,
the places
you
like
that?
To pre-order. Your
Did I write the introduction to that book? I don't know. It sounds familiar.
Turns out no one
so many introductions for my author friends.
Turns out no one wrote the introduction for that book. That one fell through.
This is a book.
The book just starts.
All right, let's get on to... Oh, this is sad news. See, I'm sorry. What a terrible transition. Sorry. Yeah, I know. We lost Darth Vader. The great David Prowse, who is the actor inside the suit, has passed away. And I found this to be really moving. There was a lot of people who commented on social media with regards to his performance and his passing that he was just as much a part of bringing Darth Vader to life as James Earl Jones's voice would be. And I didn't stop to think about that, but I think that that's really accurate. Like, there's a ton of really significant physicality to Vader that has to be attributed to David Prowse and the way that he played him. Jake, I'll turn it over to you as our resident Star Wars fan and as someone who I'm sure has appreciated Darth Vader on screen. What is it about David Prowse and what he did with the part that stands out to you?
No, I agree with you. The physicality that he brought, the slow turns of the head, the grasp of his fist. Hmm. Unfortunately, I don't know how much you know about his story. He kind of got screwed over in the end.
Oh no!
He doesn't play Vader for most of Return of the Jedi.
Okay.
And really was kind of, there is a great documentary. It was on Netflix. I don't know if it is anymore. If you could find it, it's called "I Am Darth Vader."
Oh.
And it's really about how he got involved and him playing the role and him trying to voice it. There are great clips of like him, because he's got this good solid British voice, but it's not James Earl Jones. And so these clips of Darth Vader. But like a British guy is speaking like, and it's kind of muffled because he's like under the mask, and where are the plans, and it's just not, so it's kind of fun to see those clips. But
the lightsaber fighting?
Yeah, there's footage of him training with Alec Guinness, for the first one, and yeah, so that's all him. Some really unfortunate things happened between Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi.
Okay.
Between him and producers that led to maybe the most insulting being that they just didn't use his face whenever they took his mask off. We're talking about a guy who has played Darth Vader through the most iconic scenes in the entire trilogy, and you're finally going to show the dude's face at the end, and you're not going to show the guy who has been like playing him like that. Like that to me, it was incredibly insulting. And it's an unfortunate story, but I agree with you in that it sucks that sometimes it takes death to appreciate someone's work, but it has been encouraging to see people kind of universally agree that maybe we didn't appreciate his physical performance in that role as much as we should have while he was alive.
Well, here I'm gonna show my total ignorance. So who is that when they take Vader's helmet off in Jedi?
I cannot think of the guy. It's an actor. It's like a professional actor.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Okay, but it wasn't David Prowse.
But it's not David Prowse.
I never once stopped to even think if that was him or not. I guess I just assumed that it was.
Yeah, it's not him. And David took that personally. But that was also at a time where he was kind of getting screwed out of. I mean, he was on set a lot of Return of the Jedi, but they didn't use him a lot, and it was because he got blamed for. Not rightfully so. He got blamed for the leak of the Luke's parentage getting out.
Oh, because it got out?
Because I guess it did. I mean, not to the degree that like it would get out today.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
But I guess it did get out, and I think they used him as a scapegoat from what I remember in the documentary. So because of that, a lot of producers held grudges and then kind of screwed him over in Jedi.
I am Darth Vader. That's interesting. Okay. Got to look out for that documentary. Yeah, that's pretty fascinating. Great recommend. I went down just to sort of tie into this briefly. Some people might know I'm working on another book, not to bring this about me. And it's about Spider-Man. Yes. And one in particular section that I'm working on right now is people who have who license themselves out, or Marvel licenses them out, to appear at different places in Spider-Man costumes. And they have a stable of people who, because of their physicality, they get sent to parades or store openings, hospitals a ton of times, to visit with kids.
Is it like gymnasts and stuff? Is it people who can do like backflips and stuff? Or is it just they're built?
Yes.
That's awesome.
Both. Like, they have the ability to do this. One guy in particular who I was interviewing who got really close to getting a movie role early on would even talk about the competition about the things you got sent to Like he's like, oh, he goes, every time that they had the Macy's Day Parade, I lost out to fill in the blank. And he was so annoyed that
that's
like
so interesting.
This
that's
guy
so
got
that would
good
be
stuff.
A great documentary.
But it makes me think about the number of people who play Vader in like the Disney parks, you know, mm-hmm. and the fact yeah. that they have to meet yeah. a standard, right? There's just yeah. if you see a Darth Vader and he's 5'4", you know,
yeah. you're well, annoyed. You know too. Now, especially now that. And I know this because, you know, we always, so there's a local, the 501st Garrison,
oh, yeah.
all around, you know, and I, last time I spoke, every time there was like a Star Wars story, we would bring them in studio here, you know, bring in Vader, bring in a couple, you know, it's, you know, you bring them on the plaza, people come around and want to take, it's huge. It's a great pool. My bosses always hate how big it is because it just confirms that like my love of Star Wars is at least somewhat justified. But they were talking about how much it has changed since Disney bought Star Wars and how much control they have over what they can and cannot do, how they can pose in pictures.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's very – there was some sort of pose I wanted with Vader, I think, where like I wanted him like choking me or something like that.
Okay, can't do that.
And the guy
that.
Was like, dude, like I can't – he goes, like, once Disney – took over, like we're not allowed to do that anymore. And like, no, like they really,
no
they
joking.
Really, yeah.
Vader, you corporate shill.
That's funny. That's
why don't we just blow the planet up? We don't do that anymore.
Yeah.
We don't do that
anymore. Mickey wouldn't approve.
Man, I'll never forget. I think it was one of your first assignments, Jake, in Chicago, where you went out and interviewed a bunch of stormtroopers, and you have an amazing photo of you, like. Mm-hmm. You're kneeling on the ground with your hands behind your head.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
They have their blasters pointed at you.
Yeah, because that was, and now thinking back, I think it was just a giant promotional thing. They were like apparently running tryouts for Episode 7.
Okay.
Like, so they're like, that was one of my first stories here in Chicago was like Disney producers were coming to Chicago to audition people for Episode 7. And I never did like hear if any. Yeah. Like I'm assuming that's not where I don't think Daisy Ridley was discovered in in Streeterville.
Yeah, and instead Daniel Craig played him. So I don't think he had to audition.
The first question in the audition is you are you a movie star that's a close personal friend with J.J. Abrams? Yeah. You're like no, okay, no. Sorry, no.
Sorry, it's not gonna.
Thanks
happen.
For coming by.
Yeah.
Speaking of close personal friends with movie stars, Jake and I got to interview George Clooney. And we'll talk about Midnight Sky on a separate episode. And in fact, are we doing so for the premium episode? Are we also going down this rabbit hole a little bit deeper?
Yeah. Somewhat? Also, I mean, not specifically Clooney, but we're talking about movie stars.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's a tease for the premium episode. Jake, I said this to you before the show started. Your interview with Clooney was so phenomenal. It was just phenomenal. And what we were talking about is that he's really difficult to interview because he is he's been around the block so long and has done so much press that he can stop doing press. And that when he finally does agree to do press, you have to approach him in the sense that he is two steps ahead of everything you're about to ask him. And you figured out how to ask your questions in ways that he knew what you wanted to ask him about, but you found a different way into it. And dude, it was so impressive, and
thank you.
It was great. It was so great to watch. I really enjoyed it.
To sort of talk about when you talk about like him being difficult, like, but don't misinterpret that if you're listening, because he is probably, I would argue, and we were talking about this because you and I were both nervous before, and we both
so
spoken
nervous.
To him before, but you know, nervous, and not that like you're curious as to whether or not he's going to be good, because he's guaranteed to be good. He is the kind of person that, and there are a handful of people who I would put in this category, where if you ask him a question that he's been asked all day, he will answer in such a charming, enthusiastic way as to make you think that you're the first person that, you could ask him, so what attracted you to the role? And he would answer like he's never been asked that before in his entire life.
Right.
So whenever we're like, for I think for both of us, it wasn't so much that we were nervous. For him, we were nervous for ourselves. Like we want, you know, he's someone that you want to step up for. He's someone that you want to be good. You know, you want to earn the privilege of his time.
Yeah.
So I appreciate you. I appreciate you saying that, man.
You said, you want it to go well.
And sure.
One thing I'm going to attribute to him also is that I think personally, we've interviewed certain people who have to tell you the same answer. They have to repeat the same answer because they don't have anything else. Mm-hmm. Right. I think he is so interesting as a person that I think he has a Rolodex, an endless Rolodex of answers that he could give you. And I'll even give you this as a little peek behind the curtain. I know that Kevin and I asked similar questions in terms of whether being a father has changed the way that he has approached the gig now.
I asked kind of the reverse engineered of that question.
You did. And I can tell you that all three of us got different answers.
That's interesting.
Kevin told me what he told him. I know what he told me, and I saw what he told you. And I think that all three of them are accurate. Mm-hmm. And he just, that's how he has that many feelings and opinions.
So what he told me was no. Because he was like, basically, he's like, look, like I played a pediatrician on ER. Like I've been working with kids. Like I know how to act opposite children.
Yes.
Therefore, like having children doesn't change my ability to be able to act opposite of a child.
Correct.
So did he tell you something? What did he tell you?
I asked him if being a father changes the types of stories that he wants to tell.
Okay.
So a variation, you know, a shade off from what you asked. And he said he hasn't thought of it that way. But one thing that he did find interesting is that recently he and Amal went back through his films to see which ones could I start to show the kids.
Oh, that's a great
answer.
As
we get a little bit closer to it, he goes, I guess Fantastic Mr. Fox. And then he goes, after that, they can maybe watch Batman and Robin if they want to laugh. Yeah.
And then From Dusk Till Dawn.
Right, exactly.
Straight to it.
And then he goes to the normal George Clooney joke. He goes, I guess I'm going to have to look at Sesame Street, the movie, sometime down the line, you know, of directing that as a project.
Yeah.
And then the answer he gave Kevin was completely different also, too. And I just think that's him. I think he's that interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. He's the epitome of, aside from the fact that he is George Clooney, he is the type of person who that cliche of, look, I'll buy drinks all night if you'll just come to the bar and tell stories.
Yeah.
Felicity Jones, who we interviewed, told me that he is such a great storyteller that he would just start kind of just shooting the shit, and like he would, like people would gather around him on the set and he would start telling people stories, and eventually the actors would raise their hand and go like, George, like, do we need to go film? Like, should we go? And I was like, that is why this movie costs $300 million.
Can you talk about, you mentioned it to us, I don't know if it was like in your footage, but the Casamigos thing, can you talk about that?
The
listeners, I think, would enjoy that came up.
Talking about that question that we were just talking about, the way I phrased it was, whenever actors have children in the middle of their career, a question that they will inevitably get a lot is, how does it affect how you play fathers or how you interact with children on the screen? And I said, but you know, I've been thinking about that, and you're an actor. Like, you played a father before you were one, you played a criminal without being one, and you killed vampires on screen, and as far as I know, you've never killed a vampire in real life. So that was kind of the jump start to my question, because the question ended up being, do you think it actually affects your ability to be able to interact with kids on screen, or is that a way for us reporters to ask about your personal life? And he answered, he gave the answer, and then he kind of pauses and he goes, but just so you know, I have actually killed vampires in real life. and I go, oh, like, I was like, I really want to hear about your trip down to Mexico then. He goes, it wasn't a film. That was a documentary. Like, we all just went down to, and then I had to tell him, I said, well, I was like, really quick, you know, last time I saw Quentin, we had to order Casamigos tequila. And it was one of those weird technical, like, Sean, I don't know if you had this too. Zoom does this thing one time where, if like sometimes, and I know Gabe knows this happens because he does this a lot, where if two people are speaking at the same time, it like lowers someone's audio.
Yep.
Yeah.
So I think he started like responding in a funny way to my story about drinking Casamigos with Quentin. And I didn't really like, because I think it lowered his audio.
Yep.
And so he gives this like great visual like response, but I can't really understand what he's saying. And then you never want to do the like, what did you say, George Clooney? I just kind of laughed and I was like, oh, it was damn good tequila. And then I moved on.
To talk about inside baseball, people say they like hearing this. What always bugs me about the way they do junkets is they use that audio when they send it to us. Mm-hmm. And so it's auto mixed like that. But you can have a setting when I get to control it and do the Zoom, you can actually get their clean audio file in it. So that's why I'm always like, let me do it.
Thanks a lot.
And this is why you do this a lot.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, yeah. No,
you can fix it. They just don't. So
that did happen once or twice too in my conversation with him. Is that like he was saying something super charming? I was trying to keep the conversation moving, and I might have stepped on a really great George Clooney line. And thankfully, there was another one right around the corner.
Oh yeah, they're fine. Don't you get nervous though? Because there are some instances where, and I find this especially when you interview comedians, it's never a good idea to try to keep up with them in terms of comedy. Like you're not going to be as funny as Robin Williams. You're not going to be as funny as Steve Carell. If anything, give them the opportunity and then let them run with it.
Yeah.
It's almost the same thing with George in terms of charm. Like, don't try to be charming, because if you're gonna try to be charming and George Clooney's gonna try to be charming, one of you's gonna lose and it ain't gonna be George.
Talk about the way that your thing opened, because that was a perfect opening where you called him Mr. Clooney.
Oh, I just thought, hey, you know, Mr. Clooney, good to see you again. And he's like, don't call me Mr. Clooney. That makes me feel old. And I was like, oh, George, my good pal George. How are you, George? And he kind of takes a beat. He goes, yeah, don't call me that either. he doesn't miss. The dude doesn't
miss. Some people have it.
Yeah, he doesn't miss. That's the thing. He's so funny and personable that he should look homely, right? Yep. Like, you shouldn't get all three across the board. Because when you're
the interviews went well, I take it.
They went really well.
And it's and Jake, I'll mention this before we move on to it too. Like, I was really surprised at how nervous I was going into that room. Like, my hands were actually shaking, and I have gotten myself to the point where I can really say, like, this is just another interview kind of thing, with almost regardless who it is. But he had that effect. I really, really wanted it to go well.
And then and you and Kevin went before I did, like significantly sooner before I did. And you both came out of it talking about how great it was.
Mm.
And I don't know if that made, I think that made me more nervous, because then it puts the pressure on me where it's like, well, like, if I don't get a good interview, then it's on me. Because like, if you two had, not that I would have wanted this to happen, but if you two had come out of it and be like, oh, you know, he really wasn't that great, then I could be like, all right, pressure's off. Like, all I can do is go in there and be as good as I can. And if he's not feeling it today, he's not feeling it. But the fact that both of you came out and he was like, oh, it's fantastic, then I'm like, shit, now I know if my interview's not good, that is entirely on me.
It's super healthy that we have this competitive nature too, about like, we all want each other to do really well, but we also want to get in and crush our room. So
that makes,
it's making me better at this job. So I look forward to that. This week in movies. So have you seen All My Life, the Jessica Roth film? I have not seen
her. No, I do love her, though. I love her in the Happy Death Day films, and I really enjoyed her in the recently canceled Utopia.
We have a really good story on Cinema Blend that Sarah, who did the All My Life junket, asked about a freaky Happy Death Day crossover, because they're both
good
like
question.
Christopher Landon. Yeah, and Jessica Roth seems like she had not been asked that at all, because she gave a really great, gushy, long, like, this is why these two franchises need to cross paths, and I want my character and Catherine Newton's character to be like solving crimes together. Like, she,
I love that.
It was really good. So go check out that story on Cinema Blend. Half Brothers. I know of Half Brothers. I have not seen it. Did you get a chance to see that?
I know that. I mean, there wasn't a junket and I didn't get the screener. And unfortunately we are at that very busy time where if we don't get a screener or don't get a junket, it's tough to.
This week in particular feels like a dump of titles, like a lot of stuff that's sort of coming out and hitting. Godmothered is hitting Disney Plus as well. And Mank is coming back around. We'll get to Mank in a second. But I want you to talk about Nomadland, because you said you caught up with that. And we discussed it on an earlier episode, because I had a chance to see it at the 919 Film Festival in Chapel Hill. I liked it a lot. I thought Frances McDormand was phenomenal in it, and I was really intrigued by the existence of this nomad culture, which I was not familiar with at all. What was your take on it?
Absolutely loved it. Really loved it a lot more once I kind of settled in. I don't know if accepted is the wrong, but just sort of realized, like, oh, this isn't necessarily going to be a, like, for lack of a better phrase, like a plot-driven film. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a snapshot of a way of life.
Mm-hmm.
It almost feels like if you were to replace Frances with a lesser known actress, it would almost feel like a documentary.
Yeah.
Like, it kind of just feels like this camera is following around really this slice of American life that I was entirely unfamiliar with.
Yep.
For me, it hit a lot of emotional beats that documentaries normally do.
Mm-hmm.
That are both like insightful And because I correct me if I'm wrong, a lot of the people in the film are people who are actually of that culture.
Yeah, they're nomads as well, too. Yes. And that's why it's a little bit shocking, because the only other actor of note, I believe, is David Strathairn.
Yes.
And he shows up later as a quote unquote love interest. And it's you're so immersed in, you almost forget Frances is Frances, right? Because she's spending so much time with the people in the nomadic culture that when he shows up, it's a little jarring, because you're like, right, this is a feature film. Yeah, I totally agree with you. I had that same effect.
I almost wish, and I like him, but I almost wish that role hadn't been played by, because you're exactly right, because she disappears so much and has the ability to be able to do that, because she's one of the best. So much so that when David shows up, you're like, oh, wait, that's a movie star. Dude, I know that guy.
Is Frances McDormand like it's the least movie star performance you've ever seen? Like, she's just...
Yeah, I mean...
Her hair is completely disheveled. She's frumpy. She's like just traipsing along. Like,
yeah, but that's like, you gotta have that. You gotta have... I mean, she melts into the moment, man. Like, she she is not worried about, you know... any kind of like exterior element of her. She's worried about like, what would this woman look like? And to me, that's exactly what that woman would look like under those circumstances.
Gabe, is this title on your radar? Are you familiar with it? Are you going out of your way to see it?
Yes. Yes. I love Frances McDormand, so I'm always excited that he's in. But I don't know when I'll be able to see it. Did it get picked up by a streamer yet?
No.
Like an Amazon?
I think they're still trying to get it into theaters. They would like to hold
I know it's
that.
Limited this week, but so I don't know when I'll see it.
Have you ever interviewed her, Sean?
No, I don't believe so.
Neither have I. I don't think she does traditional junkets. She doesn't seem like the junket type.
I'm trying to think if I got her at like a Toronto or something, but no, it doesn't ring a bell.
You didn't get her for like three billboards?
No. No, she did very select press for three billboards.
Yeah. Do you remember when we went to the Star Wars premiere?
Yeah.
And you were unconvinced that she was sitting like three rows in front of us?
Yeah, that's right.
I spent the entire preamble before the premiere starts trying to explain to him. I was like, no, that's Frances McDormand. All we could see was like the back of her
face. Honestly, I would not have thought she would have been at the Star Wars premiere.
And
I
would have been like with she Sean. Was there with like her son or someone. She was there with someone.
I think that was my argument of just like, no, she'd be
Why
with
would she be?
Joel Cohen.
She didn't care about Rise of Skywalker?
That was a truly bizarre premiere, not to go too far off the tangent, in that, like, we were surrounded by an odd mix of A to B level celebrities, directors, like a really strange mix of people around us.
I don't know if we've told it or I don't know if it's worth a retell. Can you tell the story of us getting into the Star Wars premiere and a certain boy band member who tried to use his boy band
stats? That's a bonus episode, I think, is what we need to have.
Oh, that's the best!
Dude, do you know how many times?
I think we've talked about it.
Do you know that I literally thought of that story today, and I haven't thought of it? Yes, and I can't. Now I want to think of what made me think of it, but I almost picked up the phone and texted you guys, but I'm AJ from Backstreet. Just I knew it would make you guys laugh, and then I didn't, but I can't think of why I thought of it, but I literally thought of that story today.
We'll have to do like a throwback memories bonus show.
God.
We can talk about... What I'll say is, if you're ever concerned about, you know, the health and well-being of people at a premiere, the security is airtight.
Yes.
That even the fourth member of a 90s formerly popular boy band can't sneak his way
in. Try as they might. All right, so Nomadland, noting for limited release. Sound of Metal is going to be on Amazon Prime, another film that we've discussed in previous episodes. Riz Ahmed, Olivia Colman, tremendous film, absolutely worth checking out.
Yeah, you got into it in the last episode, if anyone's...
Olivia Cook, what did I say? Coleman?
Coleman, yeah.
I've said... that would be a pretty good bit of stunt casting as well, too. Olivia Coleman in that one.
She's playing Queen Elizabeth.
Let's get into Mank.
Yes.
And we're going to do this at a time when Kevin's not here, unfortunately, because I really want Kevin's feedback in this. Because I know Kevin did say in the Midnight Sky junket, we were talking to the Netflix people, and he has mentioned that he's watched Mank multiple times, and so because it was in our preview content, it's still just sitting there, we're able to access it, and it's going to be available on Netflix starting on December 4th, so you'll have the ability to go back and anyone will be able to go back and check it out. I have to say, from this perspective, I have tried to go back into that movie just once so far, because as I said on the show, I liked it
But I probably appreciated it more than really got hooked on it. And so I thought, okay, well, now that I know what it is, I'm going to go into it and really approach it and start to see, like, how did Fincher bring this along? And I got 20 minutes into it and I couldn't go much further. It's not a movie that I love. And I don't know if it's the type of movie that I appreciate early and grow to love it. I don't think I'm going to grow to love it. I just don't think I'm going to.
I think I lean more in your camp than I do in Kevin's. You know, I kind of, I don't want to say I was disappointed after I watched it, because I did like it.
Mm-hmm.
But it was definitely one of those, like, where if you were to ask me what I liked about it, the first five things I would list to you would be technical achievements.
Yep, yep.
Which shouldn't be the first things that you rattle off whenever you talk about what you love so much about a movie. Like the cinematography shouldn't be, you know. I mean, everything about it is top notch, you know, like if you, you know, but the sum of the pieces, the whole is not better than the individual pieces, I guess is what I'm trying to say. I did rewatch it, and Kevin has talked about, sort of putting it on in the background and kind of existing in that world.
Mm-hmm.
And when I think of that, I think of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. That's what mm-hmm. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is for me, where I can put it on in the background and just, I love that world. Like, that's mm-hmm. like, I just love having it on. It makes me feel better. That's it. What Once Upon a Time in Hollywood does for me is what Mank seems to do for Kevin.
Mm-hmm.
And I like the whole golden age of Hollywood. I just think it's, I think it's a bit of a cold movie, if I'm being honest with you.
Yeah.
And Fincher makes cold movies. I mean, you know, it's not like Zodiac is, you know, the warmest hug of a cinematic feature, but, I think about it often, but I think one of the things I think about is how much I wish I liked it more than I did.
Well, and one element of it, when you're comparing it to Fincher's other films, is even his colder films have a character that you can latch onto and follow.
Sure, sure.
And I didn't, in the 20 minutes that I tried to get back into Mank, I couldn't find that character, where I was like, well, at least I'm going to follow their arc. And it's meant mm-hmm. to be Gary Oldman's character. It's supposed to be Herman Mankiewicz, and it's, whether it's the way that Oldman plays him, whether it's just the character, he's supposed to be the drunken, you know, disorderly, almost smarter than everyone else in the room type character, which can be really fun to watch over the course of a film if you see how they play off of certain people. Mm-hmm. Or it can just be tiresome. And I think too often in Mank, the character of Mank just comes across as a little bit too tiresome. And listen, as we continue to go through the award season, I certainly will try again, but I shouldn't have to. It makes it feel like work. It makes it feel like, labor. I don't,
it also
breaks my heart to say that.
I know we're supposed to be judging movies for what they are and not what we wanted them to be.
Sure. Yeah.
But in terms of what the movie is actually about, the last 15 minutes of the movie, without getting into spoilers, is what I wanted Mank to be about.
Okay.
There is a huge chunk of the film about, and I understand the influence that a particular California gubernatorial race had on Citizen Kane. I was more interested in the battle between Mank and Orson Welles. I was really hoping that this would be more Social Network like in terms of the fight about who gets credit, you know, the agreed up, you know, the agreement in terms of like who was going to write it, who's going to, you know, and honestly, I think that the what ended up being Mank's inspiration, this 1930s governor's race in California, I just don't think is all that interesting.
Right.
I think it yielded something interesting.
Yeah.
But I don't think the source of the inspiration is all that interesting.
Yeah, I have to agree. Gabe, where are you at with it?
I haven't seen Mank.
No, I know, but just in terms of your interest levels and...
Oh, I'm very
After that, are you interested in seeing
it? Yeah. No,
have
I mean...
Have we ruined it for you?
No, not at all. I never expected it to be not that, I guess, in a way. Like, I kind of assumed with the Fincher of it all and the fact that it's about the making of Citizen Kane, which is like a... is what it is. I'm still as excited as I ever was in that I was never like head over heels. This is my most, it was your most anticipated movie of the year.
It was,
but it was never my most anticipated.
You said that at our meetup.
Yeah.
Yeah, wow. That's right. Yeah, it is.
Yeah,
Fincher tackling that subject. Can you imagine that?
Yeah, one of the few on that list that actually came out this year.
Well, Kevin's was Tenet. Kevin's was Tenet.
Tenet.
Mine was Dune.
I guess Wonder Woman is going to work. And then it was Dune and I think Top Gun made the top five list.
Oh, that's right. It did. Yes.
Yeah.
This year.
But yeah, no, I'm very excited. But it's I'm excited because of David Fincher. And that's kind of
the first time you saw Roma, did you have to watch it on Netflix? Or did you get to go to a theater?
I got to see it in a theater. Yeah.
Are you able to see Mank in a theater or are theaters closed by you?
I think some are open, but I haven't really been going.
Okay, gotcha.
So I haven't even checked.
I was just curious how it's going
to
play.
But I'll watch at home.
I can't wait to hear your thoughts. I can't wait to hear Jake's thoughts on The Prom, which is also coming to Netflix, our last movie of the week. Jake, you texted us at the beginning and you said, this is going to make my top 10.
I don't think I said that.
No.
But I did text you at the beginning and say, okay, I'm kind of into this. And I was. Like, it's starts off with this really big splashy number. It's honestly very well directed. It's well photographed. It's very colorful.
Is Ryan Murphy? Flashy. Is that who it is?
Yeah, Ryan Murphy.
Yeah.
You know, the cool thing about musicals is that you can kind of cut them like music videos. You know, you can cut to the beat of the music without it standing out too much. It's long, dude. It's like 2+ hours, which I think is heavy for a, to me, that's heavy for a musical. Especially because I didn't like the music. I don't think the music is good. None of the songs were catchy to me. Like whenever I'm watching a musical, a good one, every 3 or 4 songs, I should think in my head, oh, I need to remember the title of that because I want to download it later. There was nothing in Prom where I was like, oh, that's a song I would like to download. Because I've got musical and Broadway on my phone that I like. Yeah. I like show tunes.
But that cast... I mean,
it's a stacked cast, you know, but, and you know, and they give it their all, like, because I was kind of curious. I was like, how's Nicole Kidman going to handle, like, you know, because she's a pretty, like, you know, self-contained, you know, especially coming off The Undoing, in which she's very internalized, you know, it's a completely different person watching in this. You know, they sell it. It just didn't work for, you know, it didn't work for me. Everyone has the best of intentions. A lot of the plot points just seem kind of dated.
Okay.
And oversimplified. The plot basically revolves around fading Broadway stars who find out that a prom in a small Indiana town is being canceled because one of the students wants to bring her girlfriend.
Okay.
And so they take it upon themselves and think, well, if we go to this small Indiana town and make it our cause, that it'll kind of boost our image and Broadway will accept us again.
Okay.
Okay. All of the characters just seem like oversimplifications of that idea.
Okay.
And it doesn't dive much deeper. The PTA mother played by Kerry Washington, who doesn't want someone who is homosexual to go to the school prom. You know, it's very kind of the cliche, you know, like Karen-esque type of character.
Yeah.
You know, it's nothing beyond sort of that surface level of what you expect those characters to be.
We started The Undoing last night.
We watched
the first episode. And it's great. It's off to a really good start. Not to detract from The Prom. I'm really sorry, but you mentioned Nicole Kidman and you mentioned that show. So it's worth sticking with.
It's only 6 episodes. It's only 6.
Okay.
The ending, and I mean this in the most intriguing way, it splits people. I thought it was fantastic. I loved the ending. The ending, and I have very specific reasons why. But I can't get into it.
Okay.
I know a lot of people were very disappointed by the ending. So
I can tell you that going to sleep last night after watching it, Michelle and I were already laying out like 4 theories.
Yep.
And then I was like, but it can't be that obvious. Like, it's the first episode. Like, there's no way that what we're guessing now is what it is. So I'm intrigued to sort of stick with it for that reason. All right. Let's get to the blend game. We are playing hashtag Angela Bassett blend. Not only is she part of Disney Pixar's Soul, which is coming out, but she is a component in the Mission Impossible franchise. And if you have taken the time to look over her filmography, has been involved with some incredible films. I'm going to go first, and I wonder if it's going to be all of our answers, though. I cannot not pick Tina Turner. I mean, I have to pick What's Love Got to Do with It.
What's Love Got to Do with It, yeah.
It's just, first, it's like one of those personalities where when you find out somebody's going to try to play that person, you just say, well, good luck to you, because you're not going to be able to do it, kind of thing. Michelle Williams taking on... who's the blonde? The blonde actress from... I'm saying Mae West, but it's not Mae West. Marilyn Monroe. Thank you very much. Michelle Michelle Williams playing Marilyn Monroe. You know, anytime anyone tries to play Elvis convincingly... Yeah. When you hear someone's going to take on Tina Turner in the I Can Tina Turner story, you're just like, all right, good luck. You know, have a good time. And I thought Angela Bassett just destroyed it. And I hate to do that because it's early enough in her career that she's obviously accomplished so much more from that point on. But she was so devastatingly convincing as Tina Turner at a time when Tina Turner was still really prevalent in pop culture. Like, mm-hmm. you could turn on MTV and still get a heavy dose of Tina Turner. And Angela Bassett, I thought, took over the part, made it hers, absolutely owned the performance, didn't shy away from the really difficult elements of that relationship. Did she go on to win the Oscar for that?
I don't think so.
She got nominated.
She got nominated but didn't win?
Yeah.
I don't know who she was up against, but she absolutely deserves to have won.
I'll look.
Yeah, I'd be curious. So I had to go with What's Love Got to Do With It. Did you guys pick it as well? Jake, where'd you go?
I went Waiting to Exhale.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Weirdly enough, my sister was a huge fan growing up. My sister's 7 years older than I am. Was a huge fan of like Angela Bassett and Whitney Houston. And those films my sister loved, The Bodyguard when it came out. So she was very excited to see Waiting to Exhale. And somehow I got drug along to go see it when I was, I think, like, seriously, like 7 or 8. When
okay.
it
came
out. Not a movie that, like, I wanted to go see. And I wasn't old. I wasn't old enough to convince them to, like, let me go see something by myself. So they drug me to go see it. I don't think it necessarily connected with me at that age, but I remember her. I remember because it kind of, you know, it's about this group of women who are all sort of going through different experiences. Mm-hmm. It kind of jumps through, you know, alternates between their stories. I remember her story at least keeping my attention mm-hmm. while I was watching it. And I've seen it since. And, you know, she takes maybe not something that has necessarily happened to us, which is this idea of basically her husband coming to her and saying, like, I'm leaving you for another woman. But just this sense of security that so quickly turns to betrayal
mm-hmm.
and how we think we would handle that versus how we would like to handle that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she perfectly kind of flirts in between, in which she handles it well and then also lights his shit on fire in his car in the driveway.
And she which is one of the most striking images.
Great image.
From almost any film.
Great image. Yeah. It's a wonderful image. But she does it without us as an audience going like, oh, she went crazy. Like, she does it in such a human, grounded way where we go like, you know, maybe I would do that too.
Yeah, all right.
Like, well done. And, you know, she that character and this specifically that action could have been so, like, cliche of, like, going off the rails and, like, I'm just going to burn everything you own.
Yeah.
But she does it in such a, like, all right, well done. Well done. Like I don't know. She took something that I guarantee you wasn't as good on paper as it was when she brought it to life.
Yeah. Gabe, where'd you go?
So for these, I always tend to track backwards to, like, some of my earlier influences. That seems to always be what interests me, because, you know, I don't like the whole favorite thing. It's hard for me to figure that out.
Sure.
And one, looking over her filmography, I realized how much of her work I haven't seen mm-hmm. and I need to fill the holes in. But it brought me to Boys in the Hood.
Mm.
Yeah.
And it brought me to, and I kind of realized, and I hadn't thought about it, but her role in that, one, it touched me personally because the characterization kind of reminds me of my mother and growing up. And I wasn't in that situation that Trey is in, but the sort of dynamic between the parents was very relatable. And I never realized how much I connected with Angela Bassett as an actor with that specific role, because moving forward, that sort of, like, commanding sense of authority and that everything she kind of brings to that as Reva is mm-hmm. kind of follows her through her career and gives her this sense of authority and all these other. Now she's in all these, like, you know, franchise films, but she mm-hmm. plays these. She's, you know, leading Ethan Hunt, or she's Black Panther's mother, and, you know, she's this, that, and the other. And it's I never realized how much that early role, just like
being able to see an actor in a certain light, and that just sort of, they do it so well and it hits you so right that it just kind of informs everything else they do in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
So for me, that was a notable role of hers.
And I know we talked about this, I think just last week. She's one of the best Junket interviews.
Yeah, you did mention that.
She's great.
And it's hard to even pinpoint what it is about her. Like, she's a tremendous conversationalist.
Yeah.
And I've gotten to interview her 4 or 5 times, and she's never not fully on, you know? Yeah. Like, and sometimes I've even gotten her at the end of it. Like, one time I got her at the end of a really long day. And when I walked in, she had kicked her shoes off and she was like massaging her feet. And she was like, I'm so sorry, but it's just, and I said, please make yourself as comfortable as possible. And she literally did the interview like with her shoes off and just laid back. But it was one of the best, like we just went right into the conversation and she never dropped the ball and just, she's phenomenal. So I love anytime I get a chance to spend time with her.
When we were all in Paris for the last Mission Impossible film.
Yeah.
Which is just a wild way to start a conversation.
Yeah. So the last time
the last time we were in Paris.
Me and Tom Cruise were, before I met with Tom.
Yeah, before I met with TC. I don't know if you remember, Sean, I ended up coming in a day late because my flight out of Chicago got messed up. So my entire schedule got shifted. I ended up seeing the movie. I think you guys ended up, like, you guys had a free day that I did not have. I saw the movie like right after I landed. And then did the interviews on the international day. So you guys were already done with your interviews, and I did the interviews on the international day.
Yep.
So whenever I was going in all these rooms, you know, they were hearing, you know, like, you know, this reporter from Belgium, this reporter from Germany, this reporter from Spain, and Jake from Chicago. And so I think, like, maybe they had told at least some of them, we got fit in this kid from Chicago. So whenever I walked in the room, she was like, you're the one who had the flight. And I was like, yeah. And to, like... what happened? Like, aren't you so exhausted? Like, when did you see the movie? Oh my God. Like, are you like, are she, and then she was even saying like, okay, like, I'll, like, you must be exhausted. Like, I'm going to step it up. Like, I'll make sure, don't worry. I'll make sure, like, if you just need to ask me generic questions, don't worry. I'm going to give you good. Like, the fact that she cared enough to say like, oh my God, you've gone through hell these last 36 hours.
Yeah.
Don't worry. Like I'm going to give you a good interview. Don't worry about this. I will always remember that.
Do you know what's amazing?
That's so sweet.
There's a certain faction of people who still understand that it's a show, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That hey, we are here to kind of put on something that might have some artificiality to it, but I'm going to step up and really bring it and deliver for you to be able to have that component later. Yeah. We interviewed Aubrey Plaza on the website this week on Cinema Blend for a movie she's got coming out called Black Bear.
Yeah.
And at the end of it, I had Jeff McCobb ask whether she is interested in parlaying her gig at the IFC awards into the Independent Spirit Awards into an Oscar hosting gig. And she was like, clearly I'm this generation's Billy Crystal, you know, in her deadpan fashion. But she went on to say, no, for real, like growing up, I had a real affinity for those 90s Academy Awards telecasts where, you know, you'd have Whoopi Goldberg on cables, you know, swooping down across the stage. And she was like, now the Oscar telecast is just like, we don't have a host and just talking to the teleprompter. And she's like, that needs to be a show. You know,
we are
show business. And when she said it, I was like, guy, we've forgotten that as the Oscars.
Remember those openings? Yeah, she's right. When Whoopi would, and then when Billy Crystal always inserted himself in all of the, like, the classic movies and stuff.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
You know, she didn't say this to me, but I heard a story sometime where someone asked Meryl Streep about being such a great interview. And if you've never interviewed, like, Meryl Streep is almost in that Clooney category where she's so good, like, you can't mess up an interview with Meryl Streep. And someone asked her about being so good. Mm. And her answer was, I'm an actress. And I play someone who is a good interview. And I kind of thought, like, okay, cool. Like, that would work for me. I don't care if it's insincere.
Well, not everyone's been nominated for 30-something Oscars. So
sure.
Maybe that's pretty funny. That's a pretty good
that's
answer.
That's awesome. By the way, Angela Bassett lost to Holly Hunter in The Piano.
That's such an Oscar movie.
Which I haven't seen The Piano.
Yeah, fair enough. Oscar. No, she's phenomenal in it, though. She is really good. Okay, Michelle Garrest, Billy Rose, Nick Alexander, they all went with What's Love Got to Do with It. Rachel KH said, waiting to exhale. We want to thank everybody who participated in this week's blend game. For next week, we're going to be playing... What's that game? Did you...
I was going to say, yes. I don't know, if hashtag if it happens, right now, let's throw it to Kevin's pick, because he hasn't sent it to me yet, so hashtag if it happens.
Good idea. Hey, Kev, who'd you pick for Angela Bassett?
Hey, fellas. Yeah, I'm on vacation this week. I wanted to say thank you for Gabe for filling in, but I don't even consider Gabe filling in an abnormal element. Gabe is the fourth person on our show, so Gabe was just filling that third chair, but the show has always been four people for me, so, but thank you for Gabe for filling in for my part of it this week. But yeah, I wanted to contribute to Angela Bassett blend, and this is going to be interesting because I was thinking about her career and all the characters that she's played, and for me, two movies came to mind only because I found it interesting that in such a large ensemble in these films and the big budget nature of these films, that supporting characters are just as important as the leading characters. And when you have an actor like Angela Bassett, who can command an intensity on screen like she can, I think that really is an important quality as an actor, especially in a gigantic budget film. So the first movie I'm going to mention is Mission Impossible Fallout. And I specifically remember seeing that scene for the first time where her character is talking to Alec Baldwin. You have Henry Cavill in the background. Looks like they're kind of more like an airplane tarmac or like a runway of some sort. And she says this line about that's the job, the way she explains what the job is, what they're doing. And I just remember that line being such an intense line because it really stuck out for me. When I looked back at the film, I remember interviewing Angela Bassett on the red carpet for that movie. And that was the scene that I brought up to her because I was just so incredibly blown away by the impact that scene had on me, considering the nature of how large the production of Mission Impossible Fallout really is. Her character had such an authority to her that it really became, in my opinion, just as important as the leading characters in the film. Her presence was in the film no matter what. And I thought she was incredibly, incredibly well done in regards to from a performance standpoint in that scene, but in general from that character. So I found that to be such an incredible performance. I know it's relatively new, it's not a leading performance, but it stuck out to me. The second one's Black Panther. And again, gigantic budget, gigantic Marvel film where you have multiple actors, tons of huge stars. I mean, Angela Bassett's a massive star in herself, but to leave an impact on a character that is a supporting character that we aren't with the entire time or experiencing the story with the entire time, to me, when you leave a mark like that on a character or a movie, you've done something special. And that's what I think Angela Bassett has always been able to do with her performances. But those two particularly were the ones that really stood out to me, only because I remember, you know, within the 2.5 hour frame of whatever the movie was and all the things that happened from a storytelling standpoint, the big stunts that happened in Mission Impossible Fallout to whatever the costumes and makeup design were for Black Panther, it's just amazing to me that her two characters from each film, one character in each film, obviously, just made an impact on me. That's the job line in Mission Impossible Fallout is probably the one that pushes that to the to my favorite of hers, only because, again, I know it's a smaller role, but it was an impactful role. I mean, it's the same reason why people argue that, you know, Anthony Hopkins is in Silence of the Lambs for 16 minutes. He still had an impact on that whole movie, even though he was considered the lead of the film. And I think that if you, as a supporting actor in a film that large, like Black Panther, Mission Impossible, Fallout, if you can leave an impact, I think that you've done something incredibly special. So my Angela Bassett blend pick ultimately would be Mission Impossible Fallout, but I'm going to slide in Black Panther as well, only because I find them to be very interesting from a big budget perspective. All right, guys. Miss you and love you guys.
So inspired Thanks, by our George Clooney conversation for next week, we're going to be playing. Okay, so this is a mouthful, but it'll be hashtag actor turned director blend. So this is someone who is currently a director that we appreciate. We're going to be talking about their directorial skills, but they started their career as an actor. So
Larry Crown.
Ron Howard would qualify. Tom Hanks would qualify. George Clooney would qualify. Someone along those lines.
And I mentioned before we started that I was really bummed that we don't have the second Olivia Wilde movie because I really like Booksmart, but I feel like her second movie is going to be the one where I'm like, now she's
Clint Eastwood.
Really solid.
Clint Eastwood. Clint Eastwood is another person along those lines. Jodie Foster is a solid director. So, be thinking about actors turned directors, which one that you really appreciate, and tweet us at actor Hashtag actor turned director blend.
There you go.
Send us your email picks at realblend@cinemablend.com. And that is where you can also send us a review. And so this week we have a review from Sylvia Breto, who writes, "Dear Sean, Kevin, Jake, and Gabe, I discovered the podcast more than a year ago now, and since then my watch list on IMDb has almost doubled. So I guess thank you. I'm a loyal listener but a first-time reviewer. I live in a small town in Italy, and I don't go to the movie theater very often. That's because..."
This is George Clooney.
"If I..." Near Lake Como. "That's because if I were to go see a movie, I would only find it dubbed in Italian. And I believe it may be a common obstacle for many movie fans who live in countries where the industry dubs every single movie by default. After so many years watching movies in their original language, when you catch a dubbed one, it is very strange. It feels like you are watching Sir Anthony Hopkins star in a very bad soap opera with a hint of a cartoon. Yes, we grew up with Disney cartoons where the mouths did not once move like the words that they were saying. I have nothing but respect for the actors who dub other great actors, but I always remember an interview I saw years ago by an Italian TV reporter to Sir Ian McKellen when the first Lord of the Rings came out. After answering a question so eloquently explaining the process he went through to find Gandalf's voice, does he have a strong voice, a low voice, etc., the reporter asked, 'Well, and so what do you think of our Italian actor who dubs you in the movie?' He was so shocked he almost fell off the chair, and I wanted to hit the reporter on the screen with a shoe. So I wanted to thank you all, Sean, Kevin, Jake, and Gabe, for sharing with us your passion for movies and of making and the making of movies. Kevin, I promise next time I'll be abroad and near an IMAX theater, I will go and see whatever they are showing. I love listening to your stories, your opinions, and your friendly banter, even if I am always just a tiny little bit jealous." Well, us name-dropping George Clooney on this week's episode multiple times.
It doesn't help that we're assholes.
Oh, he might know George. He's in Italy.
Right.
Maybe they're neighbors, for all we know.
Yeah.
You have a few Italian fans, at least all the friends I told about the podcast, with my best wishes to you all and a soft scratch behind the ears to Daenerys."
That
is a fantastic review. Thank you, sir.
That's one of the best ones we've had in a long time.
Really appreciate it.
We don't always get great stories like that. Yeah, it's a fantastic story.
That is a really good one. So please send those reviews all the way over. And your anecdotes. We love anecdotes. So for our next week's, our next premium episode, which we're going to record right after this, as we mentioned, the status of the movie star. Do they still exist? Which ones are we still investing in? What has happened to them? Can they ever come back? These are some of the topics that I assume we're going to cover in the premium episode. And until then, you can follow us on social media at Jake's Takes, at Kevin McCarthy TV, and at Sean_O'Connell. Follow the show at Real Blend, where we post our weekly polls. And we'll be back next week with a brand new episode. Until then,
Leatherheads.
Yeah, that works.
That's fine.
George, please come on the show.